This is a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You're tuned in to the R1 News, your stop for news and current affairs on the airwaves. 11 to 12 weekdays here on Radio 1 91 FM. Te reo irirangi kotahi.
Tēnā koutou I tēnei ata. This is R1 News here on Radio 1. Ko Seb Aho.
Ko Nico Aho, and we'll be taking you through the news here on Ratu 24th of May. Coming up on the show, I tēnei rā, we have Eileen with the bulletin and weather.
And following that, we'll be listening to a pre-recorded interview with Jonathan Squire, a astrophysicist, talking to us about black holes, the difficult process of imaging them, and the first ever photo of our own galaxy's black hole taken last week.
After this, there'll be another pre-recorded interview, this time with the Department of Human Nutrition, talking about their latest initiative, the Feed My Flat initiative.
And then following on from that, we have Nico, who spoke to University of Otago academic Joshua James on the biodiversity crisis we're facing. And to wrap up, we speak with Andy live on this week's Creature of the Week. We are talking about the Maui dolphin. But before all that, here is Ha the Unclear with Wallace Lyon. And remember, everyone, it's the month of May, which means it's New Zealand Music Month. Here on Radio 1 this week, we are strictly playing music from Aotearoa, which for me personally isn't difficult because it's my favourite music in the world. Ain't that right?
It is the best music in the world, definitely.
Here's Ha the Unclear with Wallace Lyon. That was Ha the Unclear with Wallace Lyon. You're listening to R1 News on Ratu, the 24th of May. Coming up on the show, we have our first feature, where I'll be speaking to astrophysicist Jonathan Squire about the recent photo of the black hole in the middle of our galaxy. But before all that, we have the news headlines with Eileen.
The R1 News headlines.
Tēnā koutou, ko Eileen tēnei. A small earthquake was felt in Ōtīpoti just before 1 a.m. this morning. The earthquake struck approximately 30 kilometres northwest of the city at 12:57 a.m. According to GeoNet, the quake was a magnitude 3.8 and occurred at a depth of 5 kilometres. Upward of 1,000 people reported feeling the quake. The New Zealand government will continue conversations with Australia over its controversial deportation policy as Anthony Albanese becomes Prime Minister, according to Jacinda Ardern. Speaking post-Cabinet on Monday, Ardern emphasised the strong and enduring relationship between Aotearoa and Australia, regardless of its government. However, she says issues around Australia's 501 deportation policy remain prominent between the two countries, and she will continue to push for reconsideration on the scheme, which she calls problematic. Australia's 501 policy sees Australian residents who hold New Zealand citizenship and have criminal records or, quote, bad character, deported to New Zealand, including those who have spent their entire lives in Australia and may have no connections with New Zealand. In 2020, Ardern told then-Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison that the policy tested the friendship between the two nations. Incoming Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has indicated that the policy will not be abolished, but may be changed to take into account the length of an individual's residency in Australia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he is willing to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin with the sole intent of brokering peace. Addressing global business leaders at the World Economic Forum via video, Zelensky also called for maximum sanctions against Russia, including an oil embargo. Zelensky says Putin is the only Kremlin official he is willing to meet with. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has been ongoing for 89 days. And that was the headlines on the R1 News. Now, the weather.
The R1 News weather.
I tēnei rā, expect a high of 15 in Ōtīpoti with westerlies, gusting up to 90 kilometres in exposed places, and a possible shower after midday. Āpōpō, a high of 13 is predicted with a low of 4, with showers intermittently throughout the day and strong sou'westerlies easing in the evening.
That was the R1 News headlines. Catch up at r1.co.nz/news or find us at Radio 1 91 FM on Twitter or R1 News NZ on Instagram and tune in to R1 News at 11 a.m. on weekdays.
You just heard Eileen giving us a lovely rundown of the news headlines and weather for today. Coming up on the show, we've got our first pre-recorded interview where I'll be speaking with astrophysicist Jonathan Squire about the recent photo of the black hole in the middle of our galaxy. But before that, I'm going to be playing you one of my favourite latest releases of national hero Marlon Williams. This is his song, My Boy. Enjoy.
Leaves me with a ready hand. Nothing
This is the R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
That song you just heard was Marlon Williams with his song My Boy, latest single from the National Darling. You were listening to the R1 News, in case you already didn't know, and now we're going to move into our first feature for the show. Let's get into it. Last week, the world caught its first glimpse at the image of the supermassive black hole lurking at the centre of our Milky Way galaxy. This black hole, called Sagittarius A star, is the second one ever to be imaged. The feat was accomplished by the Event Horizon Telescope Collaboration, a global network of observatories working collectively to observe radio sources associated with black holes. On the subject of black holes and the incredibly difficult task of imaging them, I spoke to University of Otago astrophysicist Jonathan Squire. Here's our conversation.
Really broadly, really generally, can you tell us a little bit about what you know surrounding the photo that was released last week of the black hole at the center of our galaxy? What is the significance of this photo? How was it taken? And as an astrophysicist yourself, how exciting is this discovery?
Sure. So first off, really exciting. I think it's a really amazing achievement of the Event Horizon Telescope team, which is this big collaboration that's have put together this photo. So maybe first I'll explain how it's taken, because it's quite an amazing achievement. So what they do is this, in order to see this is like taking a picture of a human hair, like from your head, in Wellington from Dunedin or Invercargill. Like that's the kind of scale that we're talking about here. Like it's really amazing that they can take this picture. And the way telescopes work is the bigger your telescope is, the smaller things you can resolve. So in order to be able to resolve this insanely tiny scale, they had to actually join together lots of telescopes from all around the Earth to make an effective telescope that was as big as the entire Earth. So if you imagine having a telescope that's literally the width of the Earth, that's what they needed in order to take this picture. So it's totally crazy. So that's how they took it. What is it? So basically every galaxy has a giant black hole in the center, which we call supermassive black holes because they're supermassive. And Sagittarius A star is the Milky Way, so our galaxy's supermassive black hole. Our one's actually reasonably small. Sagittarius A star is relatively small compared to others, but it still weighs like 4 to 6 million times as much as our sun. So it's kind of an unimaginably heavy thing compared to everything we're used to, because our sun also weighs, you know, way more than the Earth. So what we're looking at is as the black hole is just like this incredibly dense gravitational object, which is so dense that light actually can't escape from it, because it gets curved around in paths. This is what Einstein's theory of relativity says. So that when it goes into the black hole, it can never ever escape again. So what happens with these things is you get stuff orbiting around it, and as it orbits around, friction causes it to fall in. And when it does so, it gets incredibly hot. And what we are looking at with that image is this heat coming off the gas that's falling into the black hole. And so that kind of circle thing around it is sort of the very edge of the black hole just before everything falls in and is gone forever. And so the black thing in the middle, the darker spot, that's the black hole itself.
And no one knows where any of that matter goes once it falls into the big blackness.
No. So I guess in a sense, black holes are like the thing in physics that we know we can't explain. So in order to explain the inside of a black hole, what happens once all the stuff falls in, you probably need a quantum theory of relativity. And this is the big problem that no one has actually come close to solving yet in physics.
And I guess one thing that pops to mind is how you mentioned before how it's the equivalent of seeing a hare in Wellington from Dunedin. Black holes are just blackness. They're essentially invisible. So what are we seeing, and how can we see it? And this image is always seeing the matter that's falling into the black hole.
Right. So yes, exactly. So the stuff you see, that kind of reddy thing on the image, is the stuff falling in. And as it does so, it gets really, really hot. So one way to think about this is like the amount of energy that would be required to get out. So if you try and jump off the surface of the Earth, say, you have to put in an awful lot of energy to get out into space, right? And so if you just fell downwards from space and then crashed into the surface of the Earth, not a very good idea. But if you did, in the process, you would create an awful lot of heat. And this is what happens to spacecraft, right? When they come into the atmosphere, they get insanely hot, they glow red or meteorites or other things, and they turn into fireballs. And that's from the heat of falling into the gravitational well of the Earth. Now, a black hole, if it was the Earth, would be like the size of a golf ball. So imagine falling all that way, but now rather than stopping at the surface of the Earth, you keep going down all the way to the size of a golf ball. And in the process, you keep creating heat. So things, when they fall into black holes, they get like insanely hot, way hotter than you could ever imagine. And what we're seeing is effectively that heat of the gas as it falls into the black hole. So maybe I could also explain what I meant by the size of the black hole. So that the black hole is defined basically just by its mass, so how heavy it is, effectively. And there's the Einstein's theory of relativity tells us that the heavier a black hole is, the bigger its so-called event horizon is. And the event horizon is effectively the edge of the black hole, because that's the point where you can never get out again. So if you cross the event horizon, you're done for. You're going into the black hole. Nothing in physics can change that. So the event horizon gets bigger with a heavier mass black hole. So when I said it's like imaging the size of here from in Wellington from Dunedin, that's like saying, that's like taking a picture of the event horizon of the black hole, which is effectively the black bit you see in the middle of the image. And then the stuff falling in is the colored stuff around that. So you see stuff near the event horizon, but in the event horizon itself, you can't see anything because it's black.
It is. It isn't. It's a really cool picture, and we'll link it for anyone who would like to see it. But it kind of, yeah, you're right. It's this orangey yellow hue that's surrounding this kind of black circle thing. What I'm wondering is this photo of the black hole, is it the first real evidence that we have of its existence, of there being a black hole at the middle of the Milky Way galaxy? But prior to this photo, was it all just speculation, or have we always known that there was a black hole at the center of our galaxy, and this is just the first time we can provide some concrete evidence that, yep, it's there?
So we've had very good evidence for this being a black hole for a while. And there's a number of ways, but the main way is actually from watching stuff move around it. So this is like imagining if you were to infer the presence of the Earth by watching the moon move, then you would say, well, the moon is going in a circle. There must be something in the middle which is holding it there, right? And so around the center of the galaxy, we can see stars move, and they do these funny orbits which show that there's something insanely heavy and dense in that central region. And from this, you can measure its mass and various other properties. And the measurements that led to this actually won the 2019 Nobel Prize in Physics. So yeah, we've known it's there for a while. We've had quite good evidence. So they kind of knew what they were looking for, and they basically knew its mass as well. Maybe also worth mentioning is that while we've known this for, say, the last 30, 40 years, Einstein's theory predicted these things existed in, like, 1917 or 18. It was actually someone slightly after Einstein. But then for about 50 years, people thought that they were way too weird to actually exist in reality. Like, they were the prediction of this maths. He wrote down some maths, and then a prediction was black holes. And people were like, no way, that's just totally nuts. That couldn't possibly exist in the real world. And then 50 years later, they started getting evidence that black holes actually existed. And physicists started believing that maybe they did. And now we're like absolutely sure. We can take pictures of them. We can listen to them. We can infer their presence from orbits. We have really, really good evidence. So it's kind of this amazing story in science that 100 years before it was predicted just by someone's brain. Like, they just wrote down some maths and said, well, that must be true. And then finally we're like absolutely sure that these insanely weird things, you know, truly exist in the universe.
That is amazing. That, gosh, yeah, he had a brain on him, Einstein, eh? Well, and all the people that worked his maths in funky ways as well. Another question I have, Jonathan, is just to kind of like help with everyone's conception of a black hole, because like you say, it's new and it's weird and it's hard to really grapple with. Say, for example, in a solar system, we have a star, a central star, and a lot of planets, moons orbiting around that star. Is there some kind of equivalence with a galaxy? And is a black hole essentially the glue that holds a galaxy together? Is Sagittarius A star what's keeping all of the Milky Way in check?
That's a great question, but no. So you might think it is because it does sit at the center of the galaxy and the stars do orbit around it. But actually, if you look at, say, the mass of our solar system, it's like 99.something% just the mass of the sun. The sun is completely dominant. But the galaxy, it's mostly the stars and the black hole, even though it's really big, like it's 4 million solar masses. But the Milky Way is like 100 billion solar masses. So it's way, way heavier than the black hole. And so in the galaxy, actually, it's all the stars together that hold themselves together, like this star acting on that one, which acts on that one, which acts on that one. And together, they all hold each other into this nice spiral shape. Mm-hmm. And then the black hole kind of almost just happens to sit in the center, and everything orbits around it. But it's not actually holding it all together, except for those very few stars that I mentioned before that orbit around it at the center. There's some, but there's not very many.
Right, right. Thanks for clearing that up. That helps. So some researchers have come out and said that the Sagittarius A star, along with the photo, a lot of evidence has come out to reveal that it's not consuming planetary mass or whatever as much as we thought. It's essentially on a bit of a diet. It's not as ravenous as some other black holes that we know about. So what does that mean? Does it mean Earth isn't in danger of being swallowed at any point? Are we safe for the immediate future?
We're definitely safe. So you can not worry about that one. And yes, it's actually eating stars rather slowly, basically, or eating gas rather slowly. So the way to think about this stuff that we're seeing, which is this glow around the black hole in the picture, it's a little bit like, so what you should think of is a black hole in the middle, and then around that there's like this kind of pancake of gas. And the pancake of gas slowly falls into the black hole. And as I said, as it does so, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. And just like a light bulb or a fire or something, hot things glow. And so the hotter it gets, the brighter it gets. So Sagittarius A star is actually really, really dim compared to some black holes, especially supermassive black holes. So that means it's hardly swallowing any gas at all, which can come from a number of reasons. If you don't feed it any gas, so if there's nothing to fall into it, then it will just sit there and it won't glow at all. We wouldn't even really be able to see it except for its effect on other stuff. So it's sort of in the middle. It's swallowing a tiniest little bit of gas, but not very much. So this should be contrasted with some we can see in other galaxies, which are called quasars. And quasars are sort of the opposite. They're in the process of swallowing tons and tons of gas at once. And these things can get thousands of times brighter than the entire galaxy that they're sitting in. So that's pretty hard to imagine, but it's like, you know, if this was in our night sky, it would just completely dominate everything else and you'd be able to see it during the day. And that would be the black hole at the center of the galaxy swallowing lots of gas. It would also bombard us with lots of radiation and it would maybe make it difficult to live. But we know of lots of these quasars which are doing this. They just did so. They're all far away, so we don't really need to worry about it.
And so Sagittarius A star may have eaten quite a bit more at some stage of its life, but right now, as far as we know, it's not eating much. But it could change in the future. It could have been very different in the past.
Yeah, exactly. So there's really good evidence that this phase where black holes eat lots of stuff and becoming incredibly bright happens early on in the formation of galaxies. So most of these quasars that we know about are actually from a really long time ago, which means they're really far away. So they happened kind of early in the universe. So probably the Milky Way also had one of these earlier on in its formation, like 13 billion years ago, no, 12 billion years ago. And now it's just sort of settled down and it's not doing all that much. And that's the same as almost all like modern black holes. So ones nearby us that are happening now, none of them are really in this quasar phase where they're eating tons and tons of gas.
That for some reason, that's just so reassuring. Yeah. Thank you so much, Jonathan. You've been amazing. You've really effectively communicated this tough scientific issue.
Great. You're doing a story on it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan.
That was University of Otago astrophysicist Jonathan Squire speaking on the recent photo, which was revealed last week, of the black hole at the centre of our Milky Way galaxy. At the time I spoke to Jonathan, he was in Sweden at a conference where he was presenting his research on plasma dynamics. So I wish him all the best, and I'm very grateful that he took the time out of his busy schedule to talk to me. And I hope everyone's learned something about this endlessly fascinating subject of black holes. Coming up on the show, we have our second pre-recorded feature where I'm talking to Kimberly T from the Department of Human Nutrition on the latest Feed My Flat initiative, a not-for-profit initiative where the department is providing weekly food bags to students on a budget. But before that, sticking to the New Zealand Music Week theme, I'm going to play Dunna's local Kane Strang with his single from a couple years ago, Oh So You're Off I See. You're listening to R1 News here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi Radio 1. Stay locked.
Kia ora, I'm Nico, and you're listening to R1 News here on Radio 1. The time is currently 32 minutes past 11, and that was Kane String with Oh So You're Off I See. If you have any questions or comments about anything you've heard on today's show, and we have had a very interesting first pre-recorded segment on supermassive black holes, feel free to always text in on 0212 Radio 1. That is 0212 72 3461. Now coming up on the show, we have our second pre-recorded interview. Take it away, Seb.
Ngā mihi, Nico. The Feed My Flat initiative is a not-for-profit initiative by the Department of Human Nutrition, which provides weekly food bags to students on a budget. Similar to my food bag, HelloFresh and other similar meal kit services, for $85 per week, they'll provide the recipes and ingredients to feed four people for three dinner meals. Alternatively, you can upgrade to a six-person meal kit, which will cost you $130 per week. I was lucky enough to speak to Kimberly T, a student from the Department of Human Nutrition and one of the main people behind this exciting new initiative. Joining her was Mary Spears, a professional practice fellow for the department, providing support for Feed My Flat. Here's the interview.
So first up, right off the bat, Kimberly, could you please tell us a little bit about the Feed My Flat initiative? What's the philosophy behind it all? And is it more than just meal kits?
Okay, so Feed My Flat, the whole idea, it really comes from how can we support the students with, especially first-year flatting students, how can we support them to learn about cooking, building all those like cooking skills and learn about healthy eating. So it's more than just like a meal kit in the sense that the main point of it, it's not about selling food, it's about educating students. And we don't really want the students to be dependent on the meal kit. So all the things that is in the meal kit, the students can replicate in the future, and it's really just like building up those knowledge. If that makes sense. Yeah.
It makes perfect sense, and it's great that it's am I right in saying it's a not-for-profit initiative?
Yeah, so everything that we are charging and stuff, it's all just to cover the cost that we are running it. So there's no profit involved. It's all for the students, and we really just want to support students, especially we know that like how students can be so stressed while they're studying. But it's just knowing that there's so much more, like this is as important as studying. Learning how to cook and look after yourself is as important as what you've come to the uni for.
And do you think, because Feed My Flat initiative, obviously you're offering nutritional tips and tricks, cooking tips and tricks, do you think that it's time for students or young people to change their approach to food? Further, do you consider that having lots of healthy home-cooked meals, is it quite central to one's well-being?
Yeah, it's actually quite cool that you asked that question. I was actually listening to a podcast lately, and it touched on the global food situation. And I think you're right in the sense that we really need to look at how we approach our food differently. There's so much more. It's not just for our health. It's also for the whole global, like what is happening. The sustainability issue is a big one at the moment. By choosing to cook like healthy and cooking at home yourself, you are not buying like fast food, which has been designed by the food industry to create those to be fast and cheap, and hence allowing a lot of the unethical stuff.
And I guess the rubbish as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just really bad for our body, but also the environment. So I guess that's one of our approach that we want to, yeah.
That's awesome. There's been a lot of talks lately about the cost of living crisis that we're currently in. It's getting more and more difficult to come away from a grocery shop without feeling a massive hole in your wallet. And so is the affordability of these meal kits, is that quite important to you?
Yes. So we are trying to keep the meal kit as cheap as possible for the students, and trying to show the students how we can still cook at home, cook healthy, balanced meals on a budget. So it's about buying in season. It's about knowing what are the right things to do, how we can utilize the food that we have around us.
And I think using tips like you can have fresh vegetables, but tinned and frozen are okay and sometimes cheaper. Mm. So the cost of food is really expensive at the moment, and it is difficult to provide nutritious meals, especially for your flatties. So that's definitely taken into consideration with the planning of the meals and the food choices, and sometimes kind of using other protein sources like legumes, so red kidney beans, to make the lean meat go a little bit further, which helps to bring the cost down. So it's those sorts of tips we're really trying to encourage the students to think about, to try and avoid the fast food options that can be tempting when you're short on time.
Now that we've touched on all that, maybe you could give a good plug on how interested students can get their hands on a meal kit. Where do they need to go? What do they need to do?
You can find out more information about the food bank on the Department of Human Nutrition's webpage under Feed My Flat, but we'll be posting and updating what we have each week from our social media page, which is our main social media page, will be the Instagram. It's Feed My Flat. So we'll be posting the nutrition tip, like cooking tips, and just like any other things that useful, any other useful information for the students around cooking, and we'll also update the weekly menu on our social media page. And currently we are offering two options. One is 4 portions, 3 meals a week. So the other one is 3 meals, 6 portions. So the 3 meals, 4 portions one is $85, and the 3 meals, 6 portions is $125. So in the bags, you'll find them. Main ingredients are your meat, your veggie, and your carbohydrate, which is usually your rice, your pasta, or your starchy vegetables like your potatoes and kumara. There will be mainly those in the bags, but also alongside with other things that flavor your dish, like your garlic, your ginger, your onion, just other ingredients that really supplement your meal.
And so students order online and then they come and pick it up from the Department of Human Nutrition on campus.
Yeah, so we have decided that to design this initiative so that students come and pick it up, just so that we can reduce the, like, so there's no delivery, so that we don't have to produce more carbon footprint. And if students are flitting around the uni area, they can just come in, like when they come into like campus for lectures and stuff, and they can go home with their bag. And we encourage students to bring their own bags so that we are not producing any more unnecessary waste.
It's great to hear how much of how environmentally conscious of an initiative it is. That's really cool, and I think that's something that it's probably a point of difference from all the other meal kits that exist today. There's probably quite a lot of subliminal carbon footprint costs to those companies. So it's cool to see that that you guys are doing something quite a bit different.
Thanks.
And I think it's important to try and get the message out there that cooking a healthy meal is accessible, and we're trying to create the environment that students can access it and learn and experiment, because most of them have to cook for themselves. So it's a wonderful opportunity to help support the learning and the education around how can you actually do this. And if you can learn when you're at uni in a flat, then hopefully you might take that knowledge into your future life. So setting them up for good healthy eating habits ongoing.
Awesome. So much for joining me, guys.
That's all right.
Nice to meet you, Seb.
Nice to meet you. See you later.
This is the R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
That was Seb speaking with Kimberly T, a student from the Department of Human Nutrition and one of the main people behind this exciting new initiative to help with food bag distribution for students, which is very cool. Now, coming up, we're about to move into our third pre-recorded interview of the show on the biodiversity crisis. With the recent release of the government budget carbon emissions reduction plan and the biodiversity plan this year, I wanted to find out how these plans shape up to the biodiversity and climate crisis that we are experiencing in Aotearoa. I asked University of Otago academic fellow and research assistant Joshua James for comment on these policy implementation plans. An estimated 4,000 species in New Zealand are currently at risk of extinction. This, coupled with the effects of climate change, is worthy of being addressed and has been addressed in the government's emissions reduction plan and the biodiversity action plans. These plans aim to tackle the effects of climate change that destroy our environment and its inhabitants. The plans are large, however, and very detailed, and build off of the previously released biodiversity action plans, and I want to know if these plans have the potential to address the large threats of climate change and the biodiversity crisis. To gain more of an understanding of the plans in place, I spoke with Joshua James, Academic Fellow and Research Assistant at the University of Otago. First, discussing the different plans, according to Josh, this year's plan does have its weaknesses and its strengths, which are important to consider in light of the goals we must aim to achieve.
So the New Zealand Biodiversity Strategy came out in 2020, and it's part of New Zealand's commitment, part of our international agreements, as part of the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity, which was agreed to in 1994 in Rio on Earth Day, which was the same time that we got the United Nations framework on the Convention on Climate Change. So both of those kind of happened around the same time. So the report that came out in 2020 is the wider plan, or kind of the aspirational plan, and the plan that came out this year is how we will achieve that. So we can kind of think of the 2020 report as the aspirations and the 2022 report as the implementation plan, much like, again, the climate change report that came out this week. In regards to the aspirational plan, the 2020 plan, I think it's good. Some of the objectives include things like having ecosystems that thrive, people being able to be connected to nature, which is, you know, it's very hard to disagree with these kind of premises. These are good things. These are objectively good things. And the plan takes us to 2050. The implementation plan that was released this year is both good and bad in kind of different respects. It's exhaustive. The plan kind of lays out the whole of government approach to the biological diversity crisis or the ecological crisis that we have. And there's 206 different actions, and that requires all parts of government to kind of come together and act on it. There's a lot of plans about plans. For example, one of the actions, action number 52, explore options to further reduce the effects of bottom trawling on ethnic biodiversity through spatial gear restrictions and innovative gear design, whilst allowing for the sustainable utilisation of fisheries resources. That's essentially an action point to have a plan about something that needs to be done by 2023. So the kind of the implementation plan is full of lots of action points that are just plans. I think one of the failures of the implementation plan is that some of the actions are quite vague. An example of one of the good actions is around some of the ongoing programs. For example, one of the action points is about continuing the 1 Billion Trees program, which is helping people to plant living memorials that honour members of their communities who have made practical changes through the efforts, brought distinction to Aotearoa New Zealand through the work, and or enhanced Aotearoa New Zealand's reputation in the area or activity. So it's kind of a very niche part of the 1 Billion Trees program, but it really sets out a very narrow kind of action that the government needs to take, and that is where some parts of the plan are really good, is that they're very narrow, very specific, and commit the government to doing something. But across the 206 actions that the government is committed to, many of them just constitute making plans for the future.
I then asked Josh how these plans, some of which have steps that are set to begin achieving goals by next year, shape up to the rapid environmental changes that we are already facing, such as the threat of extinction for many species in New Zealand.
So, I mean, that kind of number of the 4,000 on the brink of extinction is both awful to think about and also possibly an underestimation. One of the problems that the government faces is they simply don't know the numbers of native wildlife that we have in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. There's been an underinvestment in the research and the science based on it. So that's kind of one of the issues, is that we think it's about 4,000, that could be much higher. In terms of the time frame, best time to solve the ecological crisis was 20 years ago, or in 1994, we should have adopted a stronger plan then. I understand that it takes governments to wind up programs. It takes time to do that. However, if we'd have a fully actionable plan, even by, say, 2025, 2030, that could be too late for many of the entire ecosystem. But I think there's a catch-22 here in terms of perhaps the politics of it. They could launch all of these programs now. They could do all 206 actions straight away. However, that probably wouldn't constitute good value for money for the taxpayer because they'll just be throwing money at a problem. So there's a downside to it, is that they need plans in order to use resources wisely.
This biodiversity crisis that is being tackled by the government is linked with climate change. Climate change initiatives are highly political due to the different implementation strategies needed to target emissions. I next asked Josh to provide insight on the government's decisions regarding agricultural emissions and its latest action plan.
So there's kind of two parts to this. There's the climate change stuff, and then there's the biological diversity or the ecology stuff, and they do interlap a lot. Mm-hmm. They're essentially a very similar concept when we think about climate change and our biodiversity crisis. So we know that if we want to solve the ecological crisis, we need to solve the climate crisis. If we want to solve the climate crisis, we need to save the ecological crisis. So if we think about this, where they merge, the government had an opportunity as part of its climate change program to ban or severely restrict the use of nitrogen fertilizer. Now, nitrogen fertilizer is one of the reasons we have such a large emissions profile in New Zealand. And also, it's one of the reasons why some of our freshwater animals are on the brink of extinction. So it was kind of an own goal by the government not to take this climate change step, because it also would have helped them in their biodiversity strategy. You know, they're so clearly linked, and it was a shame to see that they didn't take real action on the nitrogen fertilizers. In terms of the government is continuing to threaten to bring agriculture into the emissions trading scheme. At the moment, they are still, I think, being very generous to the agricultural sector, and I also think they're pinning their hopes on something that might not eventuate. This new agricultural research fund to investigate future technologies which can reduce agricultural emissions, and they might not come. We definitely can't invent our way out of our ecological crisis.
These plans are very complex and are comprised of multiple steps and individual strategies. I then asked Josh, when are we going to see a bit of these initiatives coming in and the increments of change that are greatly needed? To this, Josh said,
so we've started to see some of them already roll out. We've got the Predator Free 2050 program, which is rolled up into the biodiversity strategy. And we are seeing some of the positive side effects of that. If we think about the Miramar Peninsula, for example, they're seeing increased wildlife return. Around Waitapuati, Dunedin, we're seeing more bird life return. And so we are seeing some stuff like that. In regards to the wider points, we probably won't start to see the substantial rollout of big programs till at least 2023. One of the kind of problems with monitoring biodiversity is that we're monitoring kind of alive things. Also, it's going to take years of good data to measure the impacts that these plans are taking.
That was Nico speaking to academic and research assistant Joshua James on New Zealand's biodiversity action plan and emissions reduction plan, discussing whether they meet the much-needed action to combat our biodiversity and climate crisis. Fascinating, upsetting, and sobering conversation that I'm sure we all need to have more of. Coming up on the show, on a lighter note, we have Creature of the Week with Andrew Johnston, budding zoologist, and we are talking about the Maui dolphin. But before that, we've got Mousy Ototahi, artist, with her latest single, My Hands Are Made of Glass. You got it tuned to Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi Radio 1. Stay tuned. But don't be afraid.
That was Mousy with My Hands Are Tied, and you are tuned into your Tuesday R1 News show on Te Reo Irangi Kotahi. And we are about to launch into our final interview of the day with our segment Creature of the Week, and we are joined live right now with Andy. And we are going to be discussing... Do you want to introduce it properly?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that a budumch is a perfect way to introduce it. But yeah, for this week, Creature of the Week, we're going to look at the Maui Dolphin.
Maui Dolphin.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this one.
They are small.
They are tiny. They're
compared
very
small. Compared to what everyone knows dolphins to be, they're kind of like bigger than a human almost.
Yeah, I mean, you think of a dolphin as like this like massive cow
almost
horse
a whale
thing, right? Yeah. That you could like ride around on if you're a mermaid or something.
But
like,
how big?
Yeah, what's a comparative animal?
To a dolphin?
For
a Maui dolphin.
Or to a Maui dolphin.
What's the equivalent? What's the land equivalent?
I think the land equivalent may be, I don't know, they're 1.5 meters tall, so I was kind of thinking, like, they're kind of like the short
tall?
Kings.
Stand up. The short
kings. So the short kings of the animal world. But yeah, 1.5 meters long, I guess. So, I don't know, what would you compare that
maybe
to?
Maybe like a calf, like a little
yeah.
Little
baby. Or maybe like the miniature ponies, you know?
Yeah.
Those little tiny ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ponies of the water would be. Yeah.
And so we once thought they were one species, but then we realized that they're in fact two separate species of
yes.
these little dolphins.
Yes. So you might have also heard of the Hector dolphin.
Yes.
So
right.
Originally we just thought that the Maui dolphin, which is found in Northland, sort of the west coast of the North Island, was just called the Northland Hector dolphin.
Mm-hmm.
But with some classifications in 2002, we actually discovered it was completely different subspecies to the Hector dolphin. Uh-huh. And so that's how it gained its name, the Maui dolphin.
How do you decide that something's a different species?
A lot of it is happening more and more frequently, just because of the increased technology around genetic stuff. So we can look at different animal genetics and see that they actually are from a different species or subspecies
right.
than previously thought.
So the Maui would probably just a population of Hector's dolphin that like lived long enough on their own and started developing their own characteristics.
Yeah, potentially.
Traits, right?
I'm not sure, but that is a possibility. Yeah, it's
right.
That, I believe that's called allopatric speciation, where
taking us back.
Yeah,
113.
That's the one. Yeah, yeah, stays with you. But basically, yeah, where you've been separated from a sub. Population of a species get separated, and then over like a lot of time, generations, they develop into their own subspecies. Yeah.
Awesome. And Maui being from Te Kau Maui.
Yes, which is the name for the North Island.
North Island. Mm-hmm. What about the other Te Reo name for this dolphin?
Yeah, the other one is the Popoto, which roughly translates to to be short, I found. So it's
short
sort of,
king.
Yeah, just the perfect name for it, I thought.
And where can we find them? Can we find them all around New Zealand coast,
yeah.
or are they mostly in the North Island?
Unfortunately, yeah, just in the North Island. So I think it's Whanganui, and they're often found, but they're quite regularly found close to shore.
Mm-hmm.
So they're usually found like within a few kilometres of the shoreline. They even come into as close as 20 centimetres depth.
Oh, what?
Up into the land. Yeah, just like to come and check it out because they're very playful creatures.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find them playing with seaweed or their own bubbles, or they'll play like chasing around each other and stuff. So really inquisitive, really cool animals. But yeah, North Island.
That's
and then
good.
In the South Island, the Hector's dolphin.
We have Hectors down here. And are Hectors all over the place as well? Are they in the North Island?
They're more found like prominently in the South Island.
Okay, because
yeah.
In that case, I've met a Maui. I was surfing at in north of Auckland.
Mm-hmm.
It was the weirdest thing. It was my birthday, and the universe came and said happy birthday in the form of this dolphin that started playing with us in the surf.
Oh, amazing.
It was like next level, man.
That's fantastic. Yeah, because they're very distinctive, right? With they've got this like black and grey and white, kind of white underbelly. And they have this very interesting fin that you can recognize them with, which most dolphin fins are quite pointy, you know, kind of like similar to like a shark fin or something. But the Maui dolphin fin is often referred to as like a Mickey Mouse ear. It's way more like smooth and round. Yeah.
Gorgeous. And what about maybe for the more less happy
mm-hmm.
part of the conversation? They're endangered.
Yes. Yes, they are. They are. They're quite.
Quite.
So they're classified as nationally critical, And the current estimations is that there's about like 54 individuals over the age of 1 year
full
old.
Full stop.
That. Yeah, so I read a statistic and it was like they're 95% sure it's somewhere between 50 and 65 or something. Which is, yeah, so pretty small for sure, yeah. Very, very endangered. So we'll have to look out for them.
Yeah, absolutely. How can we look out for them to kind of, you know, help them
yeah.
be a bit more populated?
So a lot of issues with wildlife in the water, obviously, is the fishing industry. So things like, you know, set net traps and like set nets and whatnot that they get caught in. But some things that you as an individual can do, if you're in the area and you see one, you can report it to DOC to say, oh, I found this Maui dolphin. I'd love to let you guys know where it is and whatnot. Or if you find a dead one that's washed up on the beach, they'd like to know that information as well. And a smaller thing that you can do, but still important, is that you can put your cat litter in the bin instead, which is weird, right? A weird thing for me to say.
Relate?
How does, yeah, so, exactly. So they found that there's this parasite called toxoplasmosis, which is produced sort of in cat's feces.
Yes.
That is a terrible parasite for a lot of warm-blooded animals. And
harmful to humans as well.
Harmful to humans, yeah. It can.
You gotta be careful with your litter box.
Yes, especially if you're like pregnant, it can have issues with the pregnancy. And so they found that. I was trying to read this. Is there a connection between cats and dolphins? I don't think the dolphins are hanging out with the cats, but they found that if this feces is put in the waterways, it can be washed into the ocean, and then the Hector's dolphin, and the Maui dolphin can both get it, and it can be fatal.
What's it called? Toxoplasmosis.
That's one. Toxoplasmosis. Yeah. So it's a disease they face, and it was actually something I found in an article recently on Stuff, which was a fishing company advocating DOC to tackle feral cats more frequently because of their issue with toxoplasmosis. But the article also kind of looks at it, well, the fishing industry is also having a lot of ill effects on the dolphins as well. So
can't blame it all on the cats.
Is it shifting blame? Is it not? So it's again, like a lot of these biodiversity issues, we have to look at it from so many angles, so many sides. So,
and it blows my mind that there's only 50, 60 of these. That's so close to extinction, it's not even funny.
It is, yes. Yeah, it's quite dire. And there's a lot of issues, obviously, with small populations. You know, you have
there will be family, won't they? They'll
yeah, there's things like inbreeding depression, where if there's inbreeding occurring, then you get ill effects. I think it's called stochastic issues, which is basically just random events. Like, say, if a storm comes in and separates a mother from its calf, then that is a much dire effect on a small population than it is on a large population, per se.
Right.
So there's lots of issues that can happen with these guys. So, yeah.
And with that whole, like, separation thing, that just reminded me, how do they communicate with dolphins? You know, if one of them does get strayed from, like, its mum or something, like, how do they communicate with each other?
They have this amazing thing, which is quite often seen in dolphins, and probably you know it most commonly, listeners, as bats, which is echolocation. Mm. So they have this amazing thing where, I'm sure you know, but just so that you know again, it's where they have this high-frequency click that they send out, it reverberates on all the objects around them, and it comes back and they can get this sort of idea of their environment. So they use that for communicating with each other, they use that for hunting, for knowing where debris and obstacles like boats are. It's awesome.
That's amazing. Did you know humans even have the capacity to do that?
No.
I've seen videos of people.
Really?
Yeah, some blind people. Because you know when you lose one sense, you kind of make up for it in gaining
the
another.
The other can develop a bit.
Some blind people can actually develop the sixth sense of echolocation.
Wow.
By just going, they've just gone like
clicking.
That and kind of waiting for the response of all the, you know, the reverberation from the walls and stuff. So, yeah.
Incredible.
It's not just dolphins and bats.
Yeah.
No, but that's awesome. But so their clicks are real high frequency.
Yes.
Like, we can't hear them.
We wouldn't be able to hear them, no. So the dolphin clicks are somewhere around the 125 kHz, whereas human ears only get to about 20 kHz.
Right.
So yeah, nowhere near. You can go onto the DOC website if you search up Maui dolphins. They have a recording that's very slowed down, and you can have sort of a sense of what it sounds like. Yeah.
And Dolphins are incredibly intelligent animals. They could be speaking some kind of cryptic. They could be planning a revolt. Just 50 of them.
Yeah, they could. They could staging take over a small town.
Yeah.
Have you seen is it Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Where
that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Good, thanks for all the fish.
Exactly.
We're,
so long.
We're out of here. So long, and thanks for all the fish.
Yeah. No, yeah, very, yeah, very intelligent creatures, and I think that's just makes them so much more cool. Around them, and you see them, they will often play with the boats and whatnot, and it's fantastic to see, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess also to that, if there's lots of boats crowding a pod of dolphins, then wait your turn, a boat will hopefully leave, and then you can come in. They recommend, like, 3 boats per pod of dolphin if you're looking at them.
Right.
But they are very playful.
So. And not getting too close.
Not getting too close.
If they want to come up to you, they'll come up to you.
Yeah. And they're very inquisitive, and there's reports of them using their echolocation to know that we as humans are air breathing, because they can sense like a hollowness in where our lungs are.
Whoa.
So then that makes them very inquisitive, like, oh, what's this thing in the water? And they might come over and say hi to you, which is really cool.
Oh man,
yeah,
that's incredible. And so they don't feel the same kind of they're not as amicable with things that don't breathe air, or?
Well, I mean, there might be food, you know, it might be, it might be something else if it's small, obviously. But I think it's just because it's so unique and they're inquisitive and they want to know what's going on.
Gorgeous. Well, you've heard about these beautiful little animals. You've heard the fact that there's only 50, 60 of them left. And if that doesn't wake you into some kind of deep worry, then I don't know what will. As Andrew said, you can. There are various things you can do. You can watch where you put your cat litter. You can lobby the fishing industry to change its behavior.
Yeah, absolutely.
So is bycatch a common problem?
With set nets?
Net.
Yes. There's no reports of Maui dolphin being caught in trawl nets, but that seems to be just a fact that there's so little of them that we haven't found, because they have found Hector's dolphin in trawl nets.
Right.
So it's very possible that's happening as well.
Well, that's the Maui's dolphin for you. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, thank you guys
once again.
This is one of my favorite things to do every week. I absolutely love being on here and talking about animals.
It's amazing. It's we're all learning so many
so
things.
So much fun.
We're all learning so many things.
It's nuts.
And for once, it wasn't a bird.
Yeah, I know. I thought about that. I was like, what can we do this week? So, yeah, we'll have a bird next week, maybe.
Yeah, cool. Let's get back on the bird buzz. Awesome. Well, it's been a great show. It's, it's a bit over time. We probably should get out of the booth and make way for the next show. But to quickly wrap up what we've been up to, what's been happening?
Well, you spoke to astrophysicist Jonathan Squire on the latest image of a black hole at the center of our Milky Way galaxy. But it is a friendly black hole, and it's just a very cool thing to admire.
Yes, it's
but
not
no
eating,
real danger.
It's not eating as much as we thought, and so it's not going to eat us anytime soon.
And after that, we had Feed My Flat Initiative, where Seb spoke to students on the meal kits, which are being presented by the Department of Human Nutrition, and he spoke with student Kimberly T about the initiative. And then after that, I talked about New Zealand's biodiversity crisis with academic fellow and research assistant Joshua James about the multiple biodiversity action and emissions reduction plans and whether they actually meet the much-needed action to combat our biodiversity and climate crisis.
Which was quite coincidental, because just after that we talked to Andy about a severely endangered creature of the week, Maui dolphin.
I had to cut out a bit just for time from the interview I did with Josh, but we did mention fisheries as well, and I know we mentioned fisheries and we were having this really good conversation about it, but just for time I couldn't really like add it on. But it's crazy though that just got brought up and
serendipitously found its way into the conversation with Andy. Anyway.
There we go.
It's New Zealand Music Month, and it's the best month of the year because we play the best music in the world.
And one of the best songs in the world, I'm not biased at all in saying this, is Lovely Room by Man Ray. Thank you for tuning in. This has been R1 News.
such an avowed existence. It's needless to say we're all in over our heads. It's so point of view.
Thanks for listening to Radio 1 91 FM podcast. All of our content lives online at r1.co.nz.